at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Good morning. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today, our guest is no stranger to our show. He's been on many times before, Councilman Brandon Ellington. Good morning, Councilman Ellington. How are we doing this morning?
I'm doing good, Joe. How are you doing today?
Not too bad. Councilman Ellington, can you tell listeners who may not know who you are a little bit about yourself?
That's a hard one. Brandon Ellington, 3rd District at Large City Council. Started my political career about 8.5-9 years ago at the Capitol. So at the Capitol, I was a state rep. Went from being vice chair of the Black Caucus, the chair of the Black Caucus, the Democratic Whip. And then I decided to come home. Prior to that, did nothing but community organizing and trying to advance the cause of social understanding, and particularly in the Black community. In a nutshell.
As you said, 3rd District, you're elected 3rd District at large. What does at large mean?
Well, to me, it's true representation. So at large is citywide. So I represent the 3rd District, but when I assess issues, I try to assess them in a universal citywide application. But I do represent the east side of Kansas City.
So, Councilman Ellington, you're coming up in August. It'll be your second year in office. But what do you think is your most significant accomplishment as a member of the city council year to date?
That would again be a hard one because I didn't had wins, then got certain ordinances done. There's a lot of institutional changes that I would like to see. So I'm going to start with one, but I'm not going to say this is the most significant because there's another component that is associated with this. So before the Christmas break, I was able to pass out the Office of Citizens Engagement as a resolution. Now the work is getting it finalized and then coming back in front of the council as an ordinance. If this is fully adopted, in my belief, and I should be able to factually show this before the end of my first term, it should have a significant change in the way the grant process when it comes to criminal justice, DOJ dollars is administrated. It should have a significant improvement on programs, social programs, outcomes, and metrics, because that's actually part of the office, and also a greater network of social service deliverables. And basically what I'm saying is the Office of Citizen Engagement in this resolution form would coordinate all of the Department of Justice grants into one silo. It requires the office to engage the community in contracts for service deliverables with a metric. So as opposed to us giving our criminal justice dollars away to organizations that, let's say, they do de-escalation or mediation with no numbers or no rubrics or no intrinsic value to the person that receives it, that would be different. you will qualify off of the scale, metric, and quality of the program. So if you say you're doing 15 youth, 5 to 18 or 18 to 25, and this is the curriculum, and this is the time frame, et cetera, if you can't show that those are the you met those metrics, you won't qualify for that funding. So we're talking about STEM programs. We're talking about more programs that target transient communities and all of these issues that typically create violence, creates uneasiness in the community, and definitely creates blight by utilizing it in a different fashion. And then I have another resolution that I'll be filing today, engaging the director of Parks and Rec to start some of the process of this homeless enclave that I'm working on. But the most significant would definitely be the Office of Citizens Engagement. Talking to the city manager, there's probably a few other components that might go in this office that we believe is equitable to go in there. And some of the other concerns from my colleagues, not in relation to my ordinance, but just in some of the things that they talked about with equity officers and different things of that nature, this office would actually make a perfect conduit, even though that wasn't the original thought.
We're going to be talking about crime today, homelessness, the Public Infrastructure Advisory Committee projects, trash, development, and food insecurity. But before we get to that, I have to ask you this question. We have all saw the videos, the images of what happened last week at the Capitol in D.C., 5 people killed. What was your response when you saw that on TV?
Well, this is probably going to be my Malcolm X moment. I wasn't as shocked and dismayed as most people are. I actually took it in various capacities. One, it definitely shows privilege at its highest. It also exposes what I believe power concedes to. So we have two distinct parallels in time frame and social advancement or stagnation. So in the minority, so-called minority community, definitely in the black community, we've been talking about similar issues for over 50 years. When that comes to housing, when that comes to employment, when that comes to not being murdered in the street by civil servants, not being drugged in the street by civil servants, when it comes to the biasness of the court systems and the whole nine. So when we look at what happened in D.C., it exposed both. So to the so-called minority, I think they should take an understanding that not violence per se, but aggressive organizing is a necessity. From the so-called majority society, I've seen a fragmentation of thoughts. This is wrong. We shouldn't do this. It's unequal laws, or there's no different than the BML. Well, for the people in the category of this is wrong and this exposes racism, why hasn't the conversation transitioned quickly to eradicating certain barriers in the law or eradicating certain misjustices in the law? Conversation hasn't even shifted that way. And for the people that are comparing it to BLM, that shows a misunderstanding of not only the issue, but a deep-rooted embedment in privilege. You can't equate being upset to the outcome of an election to being synonymous with over 50 years of being murdered and left in streets. It's not even the same messaging, nor was it the same display of aggression. So you have something to say, you had cars being broken, you had people spray painting things and BLM. Okay, that may be true. But what we seen at the Capitol was all federal crimes. So when you mentioned the 5 people that was murdered, underneath the felony doctrine rule, everybody should have been charged with that. That was a riot. They broke windows, ran into the Capitol, which is actually illegal to do in that fashion, in that nature. But we're not even talking about arresting. we're blaming, or at least the mass media is blaming, Trump and the politicians. And yes, they had a hand in it, but that still does not negate the illegal activity that took place. Everybody that was in that hallway should have been charged with murder, because that's the felony doctrine rule. Had that been a BLM protest and a cop was murdered by being beat with a fire extinguisher, I'm pretty sure everybody wouldn't have been charged. When we see the gentleman, the young gentleman from St. Louis that got life, I mean, I believe life, for breaking a window at a BML protest. No, Mike Brown protest. But again, that goes back to adjusting and changing the law. So I wasn't as shocked or even as angry as we see some people posturing. I'm more concerned about the lack there of realness around what has actually happened and what is actually still happening.
Well, we have to start out with the most difficult thing that Kansas City had to face last year, which was we had a record number of murders in 2020. 176 mm-hmm. people were killed in Kansas City. What are your thoughts about this and the increase in the murder rate?
Yeah, this has been the hardest for me. And this has probably been the one that I lose the most sleep on and the most dissatisfied. So we started a No More Excuses coalition. Throughout the coalition, and this will answer the question of what I think we can do and what should be done. Through the No More Excuses coalition, we've been organizing, we've been doing, creating events. We have some events coming up in the future with financial literacy classes, a job. We've been doing job fairs. We've been targeting neighborhoods, getting out and walking, knocking on doors, communicating with certain problematic properties in the community. But this is the long road, because it's a social, in my opinion, it's a social change that has to happen in the moralistic understanding, right? We've already had a murder a day this year. And as a black man that actually lives in the inner city and that comes from the inner city, not has just survived in the inner city, but actually comes from everything that populates it, it saddens me, because I understand that it's more than programs. It's more than give outs. It's actually doing that hard work of changing a culture and a culturalistic understanding coupled with resources. So some of the things that we've been working on to try to reduce crime, and you've been extremely valuable by being the PIAC rep, and most people don't know this, but the way that you coordinated resources in these parks, I believe, is going to significantly start reducing stress factors, because now these kids are going to have outlets and they're going to have certain venues. And even the way that the whole overall scope is looking, that's one thing, creating community connectors. The other thing will be securing property and infrastructure. So a few things that I've done, hopefully, that will reduce crime is passing the support hubs last year. The support hubs allows individuals, nonprofits, et cetera, that has an evidence-based program to take over these properties, whether that's vacant lots, whether that's houses, or buildings that the city has, and it requires the city manager to go in negotiation with them. I'm currently in working with an individual that probably would be putting a workforce development program in the inner city very soon in the city building through the support hubs. The support hubs and the utilization of the community understanding how to use those should reduce crime, because it proliferates more evidence-based programming, more STEM programming, which again goes to the social setting and the culturalistic shift. Then we have a couple organizations in the No More Excuses Coalition that has been doing community policing. This becomes important when you look at the Office of Citizens Engagement that I'm trying to finalize. Again, we got the resolution out, but we're going for the office. Once we get an office finalized, now we can actually go into concrete service deliverable contracts. So as opposed to talking about PD that is only reactive to crime by statute, by mandate, and by institution, we change that and we have a more proactive community-based approach to not only understanding the community ills, but actually coupling those with resources. And the homeless enclave would be a third tier. But that goes to the transient population and some property crimes and other things that we typically have in the inner city. So I said all that to say this. Crime is like an onion, and it has to be delicately sliced. I don't believe crime is related to any culturalistic factor outside of community determination. Once a community is determining their rules and their values, you don't really have crime in those areas because you have investment, you have ownership, and you have buy-in.
Councilman Ellington, of the 176 homicides, only 91 were solved. This is a 73% clearance rate. As you were saying, change only happens when people take action. What do we do, or what do we need to do to get the community involved and engaged so that we can get more of the crime solved and it'll be less of those situations where it's being handled between individuals on the street with retaliation and payback?
All right, now, I gave you part of the culture understanding, but I have to be honest with institutional issues. So we talked about the organization, the No More Excuses, and how we get out and we knock on doors. We've approached several properties that we know have illegal activity going on. One of the things that I say when I come to the door is I'm not calling the cops, but you know I'm here and I know what you're doing. And I shouldn't know what you're doing. And if I know what you're doing, they know what you're doing. I said all of this to go to the institutional problems. There are certain properties in blocks and neighborhoods that pretty much have a no enforcement policy. Well, this goes to street justice. If I know that I can't call law enforcement and actually get law enforcement to show up, to apprehend, and then the prosecutor's office to prosecute, I'm safer and I'm better to handle it myself than to call somebody and to put me in the victimized position. When you call on a drug house and you live next door to that drug house and the police ride past that drug house and talk to you and don't talk to the drug dealers because they're under external investigation, that puts you in a bad position. When you call and there's people in your neighborhood and they're not necessarily breaking the crime, but there's a definitely tension because of proximity and maybe activities that are happening that's not necessarily illegal, the cops can't de-escalate that. Now, by changing the paradigm of community enforcement and community engagement, which goes back to the Office of Citizen Engagement and some of the organizations that I know do proactive community, I don't want to say policing, but community monitor and networking, you can reduce those issues significantly. So with law enforcement, people have to feel confident. Law enforcement and the prosecutor's office. People have to feel confident that enforcement is actually going to happen, arrests are going to actually happen, and then prosecution is going to happen. And I think that's why we have a horrific clearance rate. A lot of people know that there is going to be no follow-up. Personally, we've picked up several shells. One incident, we picked up like 25, 26 shells. Now, the people in the neighborhood would talk to us because they're comfortable with talking to us. But if I lived on that block, I wouldn't be comfortable turning in the person that shot these 26 shells that the police could not find or did not show up to find. And they wasn't hard to find because they was on the corner. My 7-year-old son finds shells where I stay at. That doesn't inspire confidence in working with law enforcement to fix issues in the community. And that's why I've been pushing the paradigm of more community control when it comes to organizations and when it comes to service deliverables. And then law enforcement and the dexterity of what they should be doing, enforcing laws once they're broken, not to be a proactive unit.
And as you come to law enforcement, that leads us to the next question. The police department now has body cameras in half of the patrol districts. What is your opinion on the department having body cameras, and will this bring more accountability to the department and officers in the field?
All right. As a state representative, I literally filed the first body camera bill in the state of Missouri. My understanding and beliefs in body cameras have significantly changed from, I believe that was in 2012. Body cameras have proven to only be documentary and not necessarily deterrent mechanism for officers. I'm not satisfied or comfortable with the lack there of policy for the body cameras and or the changes that we keep seeing from PD with financing structures for the body cameras. So my answer right now is I don't know, because we haven't seen the policy. We don't know what the enforcement mechanism is going to be on them. And when we talk about body cameras, there are significant factors that should be publicly known. And those significant factors would be retention rates of those body cameras. How long is that evidence retained? Access to those body cameras. Also, protocols around those body cameras. When should they be on? When should they not be on? Utilization and things of that nature. So I'm not necessarily satisfied. I do think body cameras are good for documentation, but they have not proven to be a deterrent nationwide.
Councilman Ellington, you have led the charge to ensure that the food distributions are occurring each week within the 3rd District and around the city so that people are not going hungry during the pandemic. What inspired you to start partnering with churches and food banks to help those who are truly in need?
Man, I got to give a shout out to my man Charles Johnson on this. This is all Charles. Charles came to me, I don't remember what month, I want to say maybe April of last year, something like that. And we was talking because I was like, we're going to need to do something. And he was like, why don't we partner? And we got to, he reached out to Harvesters. He's been staying in connection with them. Same with Pastor White. So every Thursday at Mount Sinai, we're doing a food drive, 2 to 5 p.m. We've also partnered with various churches around the community. And what I've been telling pastors and anybody actually that listen, if y'all would like to do something, if y'all would like to partner and do a food drive, just reach out. We would definitely organize it with y'all. Food insecurity is real. That's why we started doing it. From the very first one, we was able to see the impact and the need because we literally blocked several blocks with cars. And we're not just talking about people that typically look like they would need help. And there is no isolation. There is no red flagging. I do nothing to make anybody stand out or look any different. No paperwork, no numbers on cars. You don't got to worry about none of that. So just come. If you know people that need food, if you yourself need food, every Thursday we're doing it at Mount Sinai. Again, that's 36 in Brooklyn. And then we have various ones going through the community.
Councilman Ellington, residents of the 3rd District face, not only the 3rd District, but the city faced many challenges, and homelessness is one of them. And we recently had a person who froze to death in the 3rd District and another who froze to death in the 5th District. What did you think when you heard of this tragedy?
Again, I'm probably going to get myself in trouble. I thought a whole bunch of people got forsaken. All of a sudden, a whole bunch of people cares about somebody that froze to death, but 4 years ago, somebody else froze to death on the same day. On New Year's. And I say that not to be funny, but when we talk about homelessness, homelessness has always been an issue that we have not invested in. We have buildings that sit idle with heat and electricity, but we don't utilize them for anything else. But they can't sit stagnant without the heat and electricity because they have to stay on. Well, this is madness to me, because now we're allowing resources to just go while people suffer and die, and then when there's notice, we want to care. So I said that to go to actually prioritizing resources and also strategies to help people that want to get out of a homeless state, out of homelessness, and then to assess those that have issues where they can't work themselves out, to have them in some type of facility or community in which they can be safe. right? So when we talk about the court systems and when we talk about a lot of people that are homeless, we're talking about mental issues. We're talking about social issues. Some people have disability issues. And some people just have a bad time. Some people just got caught up in whatever life circumstance. Some people have legal issues. There was an individual that I tried to help recently that was with his daughter. This is an individual that can be doing a couple things. He could be committing crimes to get money. He could be stealing things to feed himself and his daughter. Or he could be trying to work himself out of his situation. Well, to cut a long story short, we couldn't get him in the facility because he has prior records. And I understand that because of restrictions, et cetera. But he's out here in the streets, and so is his daughter. So if we don't create mechanisms in which people can either make themselves whole or be secure, we can never not talk about crime with us participating in it. We can never talk about property crimes and not distinguish that we just helped that property crime or the transient population, and we just helped that. So the enclave example that I have is not a be-all buy-in, but it does create a permanent housing. I got to get this done. But what it would do is create permanent housing coupled with a resource center, medical provider center, social service workers, and medicine in that center. That way we can assess people to have a safe area, and it also should significantly reduce our cleanup costs. So currently, the city does 20,000 to 30,000, depending on homeless enclaves, not enclaves, but homeless sites, and they can do that 2 to 3 times a year. And we're only talking about one site. So if they do one site, that's anywhere between 90,000 to 100,000. If they do two different sites, we are $200,000+, with no value other than cleaning up trash. No parks improvements, no park rangers, but by creating permanent, secure facilities and placement, not only do you reduce the cleanup costs of your parks, you can increase your FTEs of park rangers, which goes to monitoring. So now we're actually talking about benefits to taxpayers, because the more monitoring we have at night, the less likely people are going to be able to dump. Because we don't have monitoring, that's why we're getting dumping, right? So there's a lot that we can do. There's a lot that I'm trying to do. And that's why your question about the most significant thing at the beginning was hard. Because I believe in structural, institutional changes. None of these are pretty. None of these are actually easy. But once you get the foundation, I believe people can flourish, because you're taking antiquation out of government and you're allowing government to regulate institutions. Well, not institutions, but infrastructure.
That sounds like a definite partnership, because I know Truman Medical Center operates a homeless resource center, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of different organizations with partnering together creates more synergy and more ability to move forward and get more things done faster and in a better, more time-efficient, economical way. So if you've got a question for Councilman Ellington, give us a call on our studio line, 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-KKFI. You are sponsoring an ordinance for homelessness. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the ordinance?
Yeah. Today I should be getting the resolution in. That's the homeless enclave that I was talking about. And I'm not going to fake the ideal. It's growing bigger than what I anticipated. So what I originally anticipated was permanent housing coupled with a service provider, which we can, you know, assess people that are homeless, help people out. And the housing would be similar to the log housing that we already have in Soul Park. That's where I got the idea of the housing, because we already got log cabins with heat and sinks and all of that stuff. And I'm like, it's just sitting there. Why don't we modify and create a whole concept? In doing that, I reached out to the director of Park and Rec and also Councilman Bunch last year, and just kind of threw the idea around, talked about it. We got hit with COVID and some other things, so it no longer took precedent.
KKFI.
After the gentleman froze, again, you had a whole bunch of people that was talking, so we was able to bring it back up. But now we have buy-in. Last week, I was able to talk to Representative Ingrid Burnett, who was in the House and for years have worked on issues related to homelessness and child education, et cetera. I've been reaching out to people from the county, but we'll be filing something today directing the director of Parks and Rec to be able to take over some of the internal organizing, and then we'll be coming back. I'll be trying to get this done before the budget process stuff, but it is a huge undertaking. We also got some Democrat buy-in, too, out of St. Louis and also out of the party.
So we're going to take a short break. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Stay tuned right back after this short break. And we're back. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And we've got a caller on line two, Rich, longtime listener, frequent caller. Can you tell, what's your question or comment for Councilman Ellington? Hello? Hello? Are you still there, Councilman Ellington?
No, I can hear him. I can hear him.
Okay. Honestly, I'm not being able to hear him. Can you hear his question? I can't hear his question.
Yeah, you know, I can hear him. He said the high rate projects, affordable housing. What was the other one? These are ones that I definitely need more community support on. All of these are definitely viable, and I don't know if you get a chance to watch Channel 2 or not. I typically try to go in on deals just so the electorate that are watching actually understands what's happening in front of them and what's happening with their dollars. So when you talk about the high rate development deals, I've been no on a majority of those deals. And so far, most of them has come back to bite us. The Waddell and Reed deal has come back to bite us. Waddell and Reed has got sold out and some other things. Most of the deals that we've structured have not been financially sound. The issue with that would be blind voting. And I think the constituency definitely could help out. If we had more people voicing opinions around deals, I think it would slow down the race significantly. Councilman Robinson and Rainer Parks, Councilman Rainer Parks, they have a few pieces of legislation that would slow it down. And my objection is we shouldn't need legislation. We should have to have competent, conscious elected. So the high rate deals, I'm doing what I can. I'm arguing as much as I can. I'm trying to put out facts, but it's hard for me to slow down deals that everybody want to vote yes on just for the fact of voting yes on. Affordable housing, I'm actually focusing in on that now. I believe there's some financial structures that we can do, and I actually asked this in the housing committee yesterday, and I asked the department to come back where we can restructure rate fees to create a buy-in fee for affordable housing. So, and I don't know the direct fees yet, but let's say the developers are paying $200,000 in red tape or whatever. And some of this red tape is actually unimportant red tape. It's like duplication red tape. And I've seen several incidents of things that are minute that shouldn't even be in front of the council. Well, we get rid of that, which reduces their costs, and then take a percentage of their costs or greater percentage going into affordable housing. We have a $75 million trust fund that hasn't been funded. And what was the other question? Because I only wrote down. So what was the other question?
He's no longer on the line, and I can't hear him. So we'll have to come back to that if Rich calls back. Councilman Ellington, with the pandemic, low housing inventory, and increasing home prices, this is a factor that is leading to more people becoming homeless?
Yeah, and that's a perfect recipe.
I know you had sessions last year to assist residents on appealing their property taxes when the property tax valuations came out in 2019. What did you think when it was shown that the Epic property tax increases in Jackson County increased over 70% higher than all of the other Missouri counties?
Again, coming home has put me in a position that I'm not used to. I'm used to being able to control the fights that I fight and actually have leverage. Down here, there's a lot of fights that I try to get into that I know I have no leverage. So with the county, not only do I believe the citizens and myself, because I live in the city, I'm part of the county, have been victimized by the drastic rate increases, I don't think we've been respected enough to even have civil conversations and changes. Being on the council, I can't focus in on it the way that I would if I was in a different position, but I believe that there should be significant state intervention because we still haven't got a clean answer. And I'm not satisfied as an elected official or as a citizen of my inquiries over the taxes or my request for certain changes that I know legally could be done to actually preserve and save people. So I feel that people will be in their rights to take all the recourses to ensure that not only do they have adequate representation, but they haven't been victimized by a tax scheme.
Well, you've got a caller on line two. Caller, can you tell us your name and what part of town you're calling from and what your question or comment is for Councilman Ellington? Can you hear him, Brandon? Because I can't hear him on this end. I can hear him when he called in, but I can't hear him on this end.
No, I can't hear him. Greg, Northeast.
Okay.
I haven't got there yet. I want to get down there, so I'll tell you what I've been doing in development. If you have some ideas or you got some stuff that you would like to throw in, not only I'm going to invite you to the No More Excuses, so we do the No More Excuses every Monday at the Mohart Center since COVID. I'm doing the No More Excuses for several reasons. One, goes after crime. Two, goes after social engagement. Three, it gives me insight to what needs to be done. So with development, I've been reaching out to different developers. Eastside, we have a plethora of tax incentives that is beneficial to development. So I've been knowing a whole bunch of development because of the misuse, but I'm not knowing the taxation tools. I'm big on mixed-plex units. Northeast, the only few things I've been involved in would be the Arts Apartments. Was supportive of that. The Samuel Rogers thing, but that's not really Northeast. The Samuel Rogers build-out that's about to happen down there. We haven't seen any development plans Northeast or centralized East Side. Most of the development has come out of or projects have come out of the CCED. And again, what I've been looking to do is actually create projects and then utilize the dollars that we have. So if you can come on to No More Excuses, come out. If not, just email me some ideas. I'm definitely looking to help out development all through the third. But I believe we have to have ready-made plans and projects. And so there's certain things I can intervene in. I'm just giving you an example, not Northeast. But Parade Park. Yesterday, there was an ordinance that would have gave $905,000 to build a senior facility. Doesn't really benefit the people down there, right? But it definitely would benefit developers. I was able to alter that in committee, and now we're going to create a program where the $905,000 goes to the Parade Park Board Association for the actual improvements that they need to do on the apartments so they don't lose the apartments, and it doesn't necessarily benefit the developer, but it definitely benefits the citizens. I said all that to say that I would be willing to do whatever in Northeast. I just haven't got down there, and I need a stronger connection. So if you're willing to help me with that, I need it. I've been doing a good job of organizing and moving throughout the city, but I do need more buy-in, so I would definitely love to work with you, not just in development, but in organizing down there, too.
Yes, I'm with it. Thank you.
And again, my email is brandon.ellingtonkcmo.org. We should be back in this Monday at the Mohart Center, and that's off 31st and Vassell. We meet every Monday at 12. And we don't just meet to talk, man. When you come in, you'll see we actually put plans and then we move on.
Councilman Ellington, we know the 3rd District has suffered from blight and not much significant development projects in the last 10 years. But what do we need to do to see more development? But also, part of that issue is how the city used to destroy houses. They would destroy the top of the house, then bury all the rubble in the basement of the house. And now that significantly adds $30,000 to $50,000 to development. What can we do when we run into those cases, but also look at getting more development in the city without having to subsidize it so much?
Well, again, subsidization wouldn't be a bad thing on the east side or even the northeast side. Subsidization on the west and out south is actually bad because of the tax base and the necessity, the non-necessity of it in those areas. Development, I believe, again, our development issue is lack of us having plans, right? So I started creating meetings pre-COVID where I was inviting all the alphabet agencies that we have from the city and just developers that I ran into. Now, I didn't care who you was, if you was the concrete worker, whatever. We was having monthly or bi-monthly meetings where we were talking about development prospects, areas, et cetera. I've had zero developers actually come to me with a plan, though. Right, which is sad because these are me reaching out to them. Now, a whole bunch of them want this free dollars, but nobody has actually came with a plan. So what I started doing is just trying to create my own plans and then figuring out developers that can build it, even though I'm not necessarily able to use them. But to answer the question, we have to create our development plans, and we have not done that. That's why we don't have development. Like all these other districts come with development plans. It's not somebody coming out of the sky. It's like franchises. If you want a certain franchise, we have to invest and buy that franchise, right? That's how you get them in neighborhoods. People buy them in areas that they believe is going to be beneficial because they live in those areas. And it's the same with us. We have to create our development plans. And we have a lot of dollars. And I've been, and this goes back to the gentleman that asked about the high rate projects. I've been trying tooth and nail to block projects and to preserve dollars that are east, and then to redirect them into some type of service or some type of program in which community can access. But we're not going to have development if we don't have plans. Like, not at all.
We've got a call on line two. Caller, can you tell us what your question or comment is for Councilman Ellington?
Oh, yeah, Larry, North Kansas City. I just wanted to compliment the councilman on his fantastic job. The young man is an inspiration. I really appreciate that interview he did with this brother from St. Louis, which is also a council person. We need to clone him and put him everywhere in the schools and the churches, because this is definitely what we need. The man is phenomenal, fantastic. Also, I'd like to encourage him in reference to the whole worldview or the national view. We have a president, Donald Trump.
First, I'd like to say thank you, and all praises be to God. And second, if I can, if Joe gives me latitude, I kind of want to mess with the Trump scenario, not disagreeing with the bigotry or the imagery that is being portrayed in America. When I was a rep, I asked this lobbyist, white dude, very educated, real cool, rich. I was like, why are you supporting Trump, man? I was like, you're more socially minded than I would think for somebody that supports Trump. He said, simple and plain, I understand the racist stuff, but I do it because of business. And I said that to go to the appearance of America. And this also goes back to the question that Joe mentioned at the very beginning, why I said I wasn't overtly upset. I believe he is a parable of what a lot of American values are, and that's why you don't see people upset. If you watch the commentary after the riots at the protest, you have a lot of your top officials saying that, you know, the violence was wrong, and we don't think Trump was right for saying what he said, but we agree with his policies, right? So they all in one breath dismiss it and embrace it together, which goes back to the racism, which goes back to the lack there of support for vets once they go out and fight for our country and then come back, and also our world view. I think that we're in a turning point in America, and only if we're conscious and aggressive with it. If we're conscious and we're aggressive with it, we could change things. If not, not only is it going to get worse, because it's normalized and it's always been there. I don't think Trump was a factor outside of him exposing what we already know, him making it comfortable. At the riots that we had at the Capitol, you had gold medal stars there, Olympic stars there. You had United States captains. And depending on the medium in which people get their media, you got people climbing up the walls, breaking doors, or you got people walking in the orderly line, patting cops on the back while they got flags and is talking about tearing up the Capitol.
Don't forget the selfies.
Yeah. And I said all that to say that I think Trump is significant, but we can't dismiss him. Like, everybody keeps trying to blame Trump. It's Trump. He is just a small droplet of what some of these people believe. When we talk about the disparities in the criminal justice system, going back to the commentary, which is irritating me on both sides. Well, you know it's wrong. We don't like it, but you have not even shifted to talking about changing what is wrong. Because a lot of people benefit from it. When I served as a rep, I worked with people that benefited from it, and we would have open and honest conversations. Like, you really have no desire to change the criminal justice system because you would be out of a job. I literally had senators tell me they couldn't pass legislation that I had, not because of the language, but because I got four or five penitentiaries in my district and I can't go home on this vote. But so you understand the institutional problem. You understand the separation and even the benefit factor of isolating the community. But that matters not because you need to get reelected. So, again, I think we're at a turning point if we're conscious and aggressive.
You've got a caller on line two. Caller, can you tell us what your question or comment is for Councilman Ellington?
Yes, my name is Bonnie, and I live in the Phyllis-Wheatley neighborhood. So my question is, I'm a single mom of two children with disabilities, and one of my children's father is $23,000 behind in child support. My question is, me as a mother, if I didn't provide what my child needed, my child would be taken from me. But him as a father is not being held accountable. Now, I'm not saying jail time, because I don't think jail for child support is the solution. But my question is, what solution can there be to help? Because I'm struggling as a single mom to provide for my children while the father refuses to work so that he doesn't have to help pay for his child. So I'm trying to figure out how we as a society can help, because the Jackson County prosecutor refuses to do anything towards him because he gets food stamps.
Okay, really. So, this is going to be a
thank you, caller.
Question. So So when I was a state rep, I actually worked on child support issues. There, I don't want to make excuses, but I don't have a good fix at all, because it's punitive depending on the situation, and it also gives motivation for not doing things depending on the situation. I don't know your whole situation, so I don't know why he's not working. I know some men get barriers to getting employment because of warrants and other things. Some people get more money taken out, so they choose not to work because of the amount of dollars that is coming out. Then there's issues with DFS. But I have no good answer for you. Because once the government gets involved, it creates issues from... Yeah, I have no good answer.
Councilman Ellington, we'll kind of get out on these last two questions. We know that we've had fewer PIAC dollars, Public Infrastructure Advisory Committee dollars this year due to the pandemic, but the projects that you focused on improving our parks, infrastructure such as those cracking sidewalks, and also improving lighting within the 3rd District, how important are these projects to improving safety to the residents who reside in the 3rd District?
Right, now, see, this is going to be the easiest one for me, because I have a gentleman named Joe Jackson, who's my PIAC rep. He also hosts Cowtown. And, see, this individual not only devours information when it comes to PIAC and when it comes to projects and flood zones and all of this good stuff, and even coming up with financial overlays, that the PIAC process has been probably one of my easiest processes, because I know Joe is not only on top of it, he's actually aggressive with it. But in saying that, the 3rd District has to start off with a negative. Before I got elected, me and Councilman Robinson got elected, 3rd District dollars, PIAC dollars, was already gifted away. And I don't know how that happens. Don't know how. It's already gifted and guaranteed, I want to say, for what, the next 15 years, Joe? Something
it,
like that?
It but, was. We got... It was. It took a year battle, but I was able to get that taken care of for you. So that money's not, that $500,000 is coming back every year now.
I see. That's what I'm talking about. See, with PIAC, one of the things that I've been doing independently, and again, I give all praises to Joe, because Joe's been putting in nothing but work, Even the idea of doing the time payments, beautiful. But I've been able to block certain projects that, you know, not necessarily PIAC related, and then utilize those dollars for immediate improvements, such as speed bumps. We're trying to do some one-way signs and some different things. With the speed bumps, we actually get out, knock on doors, talk to people in the community, et cetera. But the speed bumps is a multi-tier effect, or at least it should be. What we're trying to do is reduce speeding through the neighborhoods, and also it is environmental redesign. And they look good, which is weird because I'm not used to seeing speed bumps and I don't like speed bumps, but it looks good driving through the inner city and seeing them because it looks like, you know, now the city actually cares about this area over here. And people should be seeing more of those, along with the park improvements that we already have on paper, and us finally being solvent. And those are important. It's important to me that people actually see, and this goes back to the deal with Northeast that I haven't got down there, Gray. It actually becomes important to me that people see dollars, that they see their tax dollars. So we talk about development projects all the time. You will see some development projects guaranteed that I already know is popping on the east side before the end of my first term, but I want people to actually see livability in parks too. Financial solvency isn't necessarily a big issue when it comes to livability. So I'm looking to actually see improvements to what we have in the parks. Not just maintenance, but improvements. Whether they're fiscally sound or not, if they improve the quality of life, I'm looking to see those.
And yet you definitely work with that, with Likens Park down there where Greg is at, there's Truth Park. With Yvonne Wilson Starks Parks. There are a lot of parks that people don't understand that were blighted that, thanks to Councilman Ellington's diligence, are now going to be, people are going to have a park located within walking distance of their home where they can go out that is going to be comparable to parks that they may see other parks of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So
I can't wait till I get bouncy grounds.
I would like to thank Councilman Ellington for being our guest today, and we never end Cowtown Conversations without a community minute. We have a wind advisory and winter weather advisory in effect until 6 p.m. Friday evening, and we'll see wind gusts at times up to 40 miles an hour. Call and check on your neighbors who may be older and ensure they're doing okay. The Missouri Health and Human Services is doing COVID testing today at the Kansas City Zoo in the Cheetah parking lot from 10 a.m. to 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. So if you need a COVID test, opportunity to go get one for free. Join us next week as we continue our Salute to City Services with Ms. Benita Jones of the Kansas City Municipal Court, and we'll be discussing the $1 million domestic violence grant they did and also things that people may not know about the community court. For Cowtown Conversations, I've been your host, Joseph Jackson. Have a great day. Stay safe, wear a mask, and stay tuned for My Place with Larry J. Mm-hmm.